It's time for Let's Talk Legal with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell and Collins. If you have a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now at 252-222-4848.
And let's do that. Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. Cecil Harvell on the line and Wes Collins in the studio. Good morning, Cecil.
Good morning. How are you?
I am fine. I trust you're well.
I am.
And I'm looking at your partner here, Wes Collins. He looks, he's ready for court. I don't know which, the hardwoods or the judicial court, but nonetheless, he's ready to go. Interesting topic we're going to talk about today, gentlemen. I'll let either one of you introduce it.
Yeah. Well, the last few weeks, we have talked about different, intricacies, if you will, in the area of litigation. Litigation, of course, Wes chairs that board at the law firm. And of course, we've talked about, the details. The devil is in the details many, many times when it comes to filing a lawsuit, following through in defending a lawsuit, motions before the court, all of the, intricacies concerning, the life of a lawsuit. This morning, Wes particularly wants to talk to us about, interestingly, when one files a medical malpractice case, the state legislature, our lawmaker here in the state of North Carolina, has placed certain requirements on the filer of a lawsuit for professional negligence relative to medical malpractice.
Mm-hmm.
Medical malpractice cases are very difficult. They're challenging, they kind of have a, they're kind of like a breed to their own. And so Wes is going to speak to us about those cases in general and more specifically about what a lawyer must do even before you file the case. So let's talk about that this morning.
Good
morning, Wes.
Sure. Thank you for that intro, Cecil. So, in your typical lawsuit, you really don't have a gatekeeper requirement. You don't have the gate you have to get through in order to, plead the case and to put the case in court. I mean, for example, if you have a negligence case based on a personal injury in a traffic accident type, motor vehicle accident type situation, well, obviously you have to plead negligence, which is, the person has a duty, there's a breach of that duty and their damages. You don't have to have an expert evaluate the case to make a determination as to whether there was, in fact, based on the expert's opinion, negligence mm-hmm. before you file. But medical malpractice, medical negligence type cases do require, under what is referred to as Rule 9J, a gatekeeper provision. And basically what that means is that before you can even file such a case in court, you have to have it evaluated by an expert qualified, someone who would qualify as an expert to testify in court on the particular issue, that there was a breach of the standard of care. And that expert has to review all of the medical records that are relevant to the situation. And in the event that there is a breach of the standard of care and you do have that opinion, then you do have the authority to and the right to file the lawsuit in court. If you don't have that 9J opinion, then there's your gate that you didn't get through. So upon that evaluation of the case, if you don't have that opinion, then you're in a position where it's not allowed by the court to file the lawsuit for the medical negligence, unless you have a situation where it's what we call res ipsa loquitur. That's an exception. And what that is the thing speaks for itself. That's like if the patient is under the control of the doctor, let's say during the surgery, and something happens that is completely under the control of the doctor, like let's say someone gets burned during mm-hmm. the surgery and that had nothing to do with the surgery, then you may be under a res ipsa loquitur situation where you don't have to have the 9J. But
would that be, Wes, like terrible to think about, but that would that be like, for instance, amputating the wrong limb, the left rather than the right?
Yeah, it that could be part of a resipsa case, but you know, the safe way to play that is to, before you file, is to get the case evaluated and by the appropriate expert, and to have that expert opinion anyway, because you know, the effect of filing the action without the appropriate expert is pretty serious. You know, you get, the case gets dismissed, and you may get taxed with costs on the other side. So you may end up having to pay the other side, you know, on the other side defense cost up to that point anyway. So, and moreover, I mean, that is just not even from a rules of civil procedure standpoint, but just from a evaluation standpoint, good faith filing standpoint. I mean, we don't really know. I don't know as an attorney, because I'm not a medical doctor, mm-hmm. necessarily, what the breaches of the standard of care is for particular types of situations. That's why we have to have experts who know the standard of care to evaluate everything and make that determination. It's not good for anyone for lawsuits to get filed that don't have merit. So there is certainly, I mean, obviously that's inefficient. That slows the court down.
It's
that
frivolous.
Takes time, effort, money. Could right. be frivolous. And I've certainly had many clients come to me, and you know, I don't do a ton of medical malpractice, but deal with certain cases under certain situations. I've had clients come to me over the years where it seems as though there's an absolute breach of the standard of care, and then upon evaluation by the expert, I found out that, nope, doctor did everything right.
Who solicits the expert to do the evaluation? The patient client comes to you, Harvell and Collins. You then seek an expert?
Correct. We explain the process. I mean, a lot of times folks don't understand, you know, the 9J requirement. They don't understand what the breach of the standard of care is. They don't understand, and it's understandable that they don't understand.
It's all new to them.
The gatekeeper requirement to be able to get through in order to file the MedMal case. So, you know, obviously, after looking at the situation and explaining the process to the client, then we normally work up that first stage of the case, mm-hmm. which is gathering all the medical records, evaluating them, putting together in writing what we believe the issues are, identifying the appropriate expert, providing all the information to the appropriate expert, the documentation, along with our outline or cover letter as to what we believe may be the issues, and then having the expert evaluate those items and then communicating with the expert about those opinions. And you know, that in and of itself is a pretty significant scope of work.
Sounds
to
like
undertake.
It. Yeah.
It would not be something for a client really to take on, because the client really needs to make the job easy for an expert. And you have to realize, you know, hiring a 9J expert to evaluate a case is not inexpensive. You don't want to just dump thousands of pages of medical records on the person. Say, well, just go at it.
Yeah, what do you think?
If you haven't broken it down,
right,
then it's going to take them at least twice as much, maybe more than that, time to evaluate everything. If you've already identified where you think the problem is, then they can get right to, you know, whatever that issue is. Therefore, they have to spend less time. Therefore, it costs less money for the evaluation.
Is it feasible if you do all what you just described, Wes, and they come back and say, no, they followed the procedures to the letter, could you then go out and find another? Could you go out and seek another expert for a second opinion?
You can seek as many opinions as you want to, but it costs money. Number one,
and
number
time.
Two, normally, if we have, you know, try to identify a neutral expert, someone who's going to give us a good faith opinion, we're not going out and hiring a hired gun.
I mean,
that's not good for anyone.
Yeah.
Because in the event that our expert comes back and makes the determination that there's not a breach of the standard of care, that tells me that the defense is probably very easily going to be able to find an expert on their side of the case finding there's not a breach of the standard of care.
That's true. There's two sides.
You have different kinds of situations in these type cases. Sometimes it's more of a battle of the experts. Sometimes it's more of, well, my expert says this, there's a breach. The other expert says there's not a breach. And then the jury has to work all that out. Sometimes you have the cases where there's a clear breach of the standard of care, and then the defense doesn't have an expert indicating that there's not. So then that issue of liability may not be, you know, contested so much, and it may be an issue more of the damages. What are the damages as a result of the liability? But, you know, we're kind of talking all around this issue, but, you know, I think listeners also need to recognize that just because there is a bad outcome relative mm-hmm. to a medical, maybe it's a surgery or whatever it may be, does not mean that there's a breach of the standard of care. You can have a bad outcome, and the doctor, medical provider may have done everything as required under the standard of care, but the outcome just wasn't what you wanted it to be.
Right.
There's a big difference between the two. It's not as though we jump to liability just because something didn't go the way you wanted it to go. I mean, obviously there's inherent risk with most medical procedures. There are certain types of disclosures, informed consents that get signed, indicating there may be scarring or mm-hmm. there may be loss of sensation. There may be issues with your nerve pain after the surgery. There may be bleeding. There may be, you know, things that, if we're talking about a surgery, that are typical. Just because a person undergoes those as a result of the procedure, and maybe it's worse than what the person thought it would be, or maybe the procedure itself wasn't as successful as the person hoped it would be, that in no way indicates that the doctor providing the service, providing the surgery or whatever it may be, in fact breached the standard of care. We really look very closely at the medical records to make a determination as to whether everything was done in a proper way, in a proper procedure, and that's documented in that what is so vitally important for the 9J expert to evaluate. So again, just to wrap up that little part of it, that's a big part of medical cases that folks get a little bit confused mm-hmm. on. They get confused about, well, you know, I had surgery on my knee. My knee's not any better at all.
Yeah.
That in and of itself is not a breach of the standard of care. Why is your knee not any better at all? Did they not even do the surgery that they were supposed to do? I mean, that would be a breach of the standard of
right.
care. We have to look into it. So understanding what the breach of the standard of care is for whatever the particular issue may be is very important. And again, the 9J expert has to make the determination that there was in fact a breach before, as I often say, we even get off the runway with the case.
Mm-hmm.
That is an evaluation before we ever get to court.
Welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. And you can reach the law firm today by calling 252-726-9050 or go online to harvellandcollins.com. We're talking about medical malpractice and the non-SJ requirements. A lot of stuff to consider before this case, like as Wes says, before the plane takes off on the runway. A lot of pre-flight necessities
right.
to get out of the way.
Was it a pre-flight checklist?
Pre-flight check.
Is that what
yeah.
it is?
Yeah.
Okay, right.
That you're
a pilot, but,
you're an attorney, but
one of the concepts that I think is prevalent this morning in our conversation is kind of something that we've talked about before relative to litigation, and that is, you know, that judges determine the law. Judges are the law keeper. Judges instruct the jury as to what the law is, the statutory law, if any. Juries, on the other hand, determine the facts, and are the fact finder, if you will. And so let's apply those principles to what Wes has been speaking about this morning, the judge is going to require, of course, that there be this 9J affidavit by a expert witness. But even though this expert witness has an opinion out of the gate that must be prevalent in the case, the bottom line is that the jury will at some point be instructed that you, the members of the jury, have to determine whether or not the facts of this case indicate that there was a breach of care. The expert witness, of course, is going to give his opinion, and he or she is going to express circumstances and other kinds of facts that support their opinion, but the ultimate decision of whether or not there is factually a breach of the standard, whether or not it falls beneath the standard of care, is going to be a jury question. And of course, I find that fascinating, and I think our listeners understand that the two together are the judge as the dictator of the law, the jury as the finder of the facts. That's, of course, what then brings the case to fruition and it's the balance between the two concepts.
And Wes, I'm curious, when you're in court and you're presenting your case in a malpractice, the challenges of making these difficult medical phrases and terms understandable to the layman, the 12 people sitting in the jury box, are these more challenging cases to try in court than maybe a property case or other types of civil matters?
Just different. I wouldn't say more challenging. I mean, some, you bring up a property case, some of the most challenging trials there are is, cases regarding title, land title, because it just gets to be really confusing when you're talking about proving title to property. So you bring that up. So that can be difficult. But, and then as far as a medical case, understanding, what the standard of care is and the terminology and so on and so forth. In any case that you're in as an attorney who tries cases, you're going to learn a lot. If you do your job, you're going to learn a lot about whatever the issue is in the world, whatever it is, how to properly do a ACL surgery or how to properly do a facelift or whatever it may be, and you're going to learn about that. But back to what, Cecil was referring to, I think we've probably talked about this on the program. I mean, the way this works for the judge is that, if you're in trial and the jury is making the determination with regard to the facts, and making a determination as to, number one, whether there is liability, and then if there is, what the damages are. It's kind of a two-step process. Then before that case gets in the hands of the jury, after they hear all the evidence, the judge gives the jury instructions, okay? Yeah. And what I mean by that, there's pattern jury instructions, meaning they're provided already for the court to use in particular type cases. Sometimes you have cases that don't fall into the pattern instructions, and you have to do what's called a request for special jury instructions. But I oftentimes, when I'm trying a case and picking my jury, one of my last questions that I ask on voir dire, which is the questioning the jury to learn about who they are and whether they have conflicts, biases, that kind of thing, is whether they have any problem with following the law as given to them by the judge. Because I want to make sure that every one of those jurors is going to really listen intently to the judge and do exactly what the law is. So when you're and follow that law. And then you have a charge conference toward the end of the case, and we get straight with regard to what we agree on regarding the instructions. The instructions are given. And then oftentimes in closing argument, I'm reminding the jury about the question I asked in voir dire. I asked about whether you would follow the law. Now the judge is about to give you that law. And this will be, you need to listen to this part of it and listen to that part of it. So that's really important. So that's where it comes back to what Cecil was referring to, where the judge makes the determination with the law, but the law is written. The judge determines what law applies and then gives those instructions to the jury, and then the jury is under a duty to then follow that law and making a determination as to whether there's liability. And mm-hmm. then a lot of times, you know, obviously when you're talking about damages, that's even more subjective.
Right.
For example, I mean, how much is someone's pain and suffering? How do you put a number on that? It's very subjective. One person may think it's a dollar, and next person may think it's $100,000. Mm-hmm. You just don't know.
Yeah, there's no chart for that.
Correct.
And jurors come into the courtroom. You know, they're summoned, but they can bring their own biases. But it's based on the evidence presented in court, regardless
they're
of
not.
The,
you're right. Not. I mean, everyone brings in who they are
sure.
to the court as
yeah.
far as the juror goes, but they're not supposed to go. And they're given instructions: don't go do independent research. Don't right. go home and Google whatever this medical procedure was.
Yeah.
Don't go read articles in the newspaper about what's going on with this case if there's some public interest.
Yeah.
Don't take those things into consideration.
Right? It's a fascinating topic, and I wish we had more time to discuss it. We'll take a break here. We'll come back with our close on this topic, talking about medical malpractice. If you want to reach Harvell and Collins today, call the law firm at 252-726-9050 or go online to harvellandcollins.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, and we have about a minute remaining in today's show, gentlemen. Cecil?
Well, I have enjoyed the program this morning because, from my perspective, you know, I can get philosophical about how the law works. I think it's fascinating mm-hmm. that we have these combination of fact finders versus, of course, the judge, the interpreter, and authority on the law, and how all of that must come together in order to for our listeners to be able to seek a relief and to seek justice and to feel that the system works. The system is a remarkable system, truly remarkable, and of course hardly ever, I might add, Mike, changes. I mean, these traditions that Wes and I are speaking of this morning, yes, the 9J is a statute that was passed at some point in a decade or so ago, but the bottom line is the concepts of the application of the law versus the fact finders, you know, are concepts that have just been around for hundreds and hundreds of years, and the reason for that is because they work.
Yeah.
So it's been a good program, and I've enjoyed it.
Thank you. It was a great topic, Wes. Thank you.